The Senate Education Committee meeting is called to order. Today is Monday, March 1st, 2021. The time is 9:01 a.m. We're meeting in State Capitol Room number 205. In attendance are Senator Stevens, Senator Hughes, Senator Machicki, Senator Begich, and myself, Senator Holland. Thank you to Jeannie, our recording secretary, and Kelsey, our moderator today. As a reminder, please silence your cell phones. Before we move to the first item on the agenda, we have one housekeeping issue. Mr. Vice Chair, would you like to make a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move that Senator Holland, as chair of the Senate Education Committee, be delegated the duties and responsibilities in AS 24.08.060A to introduce a bill or withdraw a bill previously introduced in the name of the committee during regular and special sessions of the 32nd Alaska Legislature.
I object.
Would you like to speak to your objection?
I would. Mr. Chairman, just speaking to the objection, what this power does is, of course, gives you the power to introduce committee bills on your own without full consultation with the other members of the committee. Now, based on my experiences with you, I suspect you would consult with us on a regular basis. However, as a member of the committee, I would find it difficult to be supportive of a bill that would carry my name with it if I don't actually know what the content of the bill is, or if I believe that the bill doesn't move education policy forward for the state. Further, if such action were to be taken without my consultation or agreement, I would find it difficult to remain on this committee. As a consequence, I would ask for a committee on committee's referral to remove myself from this committee, if indeed that is the case, and if we move forward with this particular motion. With that said, I will retain my objection.
Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Brief at ease.
Brief at ease.
Mr. Chairman, I withdraw the motion I made previously.
I'm sorry, Senator Hughes, restate.
I didn't hear you. Mr. Chairman, I said I withdraw the motion I made previously.
The motion is withdrawn. Oh, I'm sorry about that, Senator Stevens. All right, having withdrawn that motion, we now move on to the only item on the agenda today. This is the third hearing on Senate Bill 8. My intent is to hear invited in public testimony and then set the bill aside for further work. The first person on the list to testify is Kerry Boyd, superintendent of the Yukon-Koyukuk School District. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony. I'm sorry. Senator Begich, please state your name for the record and your affiliation and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tom Begich. I'm the state senator for District J in downtown Anchorage, and I appreciate you giving me an opportunity to say a few words before the testimony begins. But let me start by saying thank you for your consideration of moving forward on a path that keeps the committee working positively, and I appreciate that very, very much from our earlier discussion. As you all know from our last discussion, SB 8 is a bill that deals with three components of education that we believe will help move this state's children to a better place when it comes to graduation outcomes, life outcomes, and in general as building successful citizens for the state. Part of that is the integration of the three elements that we've identified in the bill that I discussed last week, but just to reiterate, good quality early voluntary pre-K backed up by good quality strong reading programming and supported by the investment from the State Department of Education are critically intertwined in this effort. As a consequence, when you combine these three elements, you have a chance of actually moving education policy forward. This is the primary component of the bill that the governor, Governor Dunleavy, myself, and the Commissioner of Education worked on. And I just want to say a couple of quick comments about it and then turn it over to the testimony that we have online, which includes testimony from the Alaska Education Association, the Alaska Policy Forum, and three superintendents representing urban and rural school districts, all of whom have had experiences with or understand the interrelationship of these three components. There's a bill in the legislature right now, Mr. Chairman. It's a bill dealing with alcohol industry. It's massive. The President of the Senate has shepherded this bill for, is it nearly a decade now, Mr. President? It's been nearly a decade. Hundreds of hours have been put into that bill. And there's one common thing. We don't ever start with that bill from where we left. We never start from where we began. We always start from where we left off, in hopes that we'll get it through, because it's a bill that's needed, it's a bill that's necessary. This bill's similar to that. Whether it's this version, SB 8, whether it's a modified version of SB 42, whether it's a bill, whatever the bill is that comes out of this committee, must be the product of the hundreds of hours that have already been invested in this process by the administration, by professionals in the field, and by parents, by teachers, by everyone who's been working on the bill and education policy. The role of this committee, as with every policy committee, is to set the policies out in statute that are necessary to achieve success. The ability to do that and to establish a legacy for education is what we've all struggled with on this committee, Mr. Chairman. If we do less than that as a policy committee, we're doing less than what we can do for kids and less than what we can do for parents. We can dispute the fiscal issues around the bill. We can dispute the amount of money it may cost, but our job is not to worry about the cost for now. It's to worry about the policy we create and whether it will or won't succeed. So whether it's SB 8 or a committee substitute of this bill, whether it's SB 42 or a committee substitute of that bill, what matters is that the policy this committee produces is one where a parent or a teacher or a superintendent can stand up and say, that's going to change things. Because we're last place, Mr. Chairman, and we can't stay in last place. It's not fair to our children, it's not fair to our parents, and it's not fair to our professionals. With that, I'm pleased that we have the five folks we have on. I don't agree with everything that you're going to hear today, Mr. Chairman, but I do agree that it takes a group of folks who actually have to get their fingers dirty in this work to make good policy. And so thank you again for the opportunity to present, Mr. Chairman, and I leave it to you to call on the testifiers.
Thank you, Senator Begich. I had initially mentioned Carrie Boyd. I don't believe she is online right now, so we'll go down to the next person on the list. Tom Claymire, President, NEA Alaska. Mr. Claymire, if you'd like to state your name and affiliation with the record and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Chairman Holland. This is Tom Claymire of NEA Alaska. Can you hear me okay? I'm getting kind of a feedback where I was.
We hear you just fine. No feedback on our end.
Okay. Well, thank you very much again for having me, giving me the opportunity to testify on behalf of our members. Also appreciate Senator Begich for sponsoring the legislation and the invite today to speak in favor of it. In addition, I would like to thank Governor Dunleavy for his vision and leadership by embarking on the process to focus our efforts on this fundamental skill of reading beginning last legislative session. And both Senator Hughes and Senator Stevens have also been leaders in the focus on reading, which we all know is a fundamental life skill and a keystone learning tool. So thank you as well. Finally, I'd be remiss if I didn't recognize Commissioner Johnson for his continued engagement and commitment to working with Alaska's educators and other stakeholders and facilitating the conversation and developing common sense and meaningful education policy. The product of that work, now reintroduced as Senate Bill 8, of course, represents the input and collaboration from literally hundreds, if not thousands, of Alaskans working together. From the perspective of educators, this bill represents the best of what is possible when legislators, department officials, and stakeholders work together to craft evidence-based policy that puts students and student learning first. As a social studies teacher and former Air Force member, it pleases me greatly. This is kind of the epitome of civic engagement. It's a model of how government's supposed to work, of the people, by the people, for the people. And so I guess let me back up a little bit and add a little bit of perspective and history for those that aren't as familiar to help frame the conversation and convey how extensive this process was. And it begins actually, I think, before the bill itself. It began, in my view, with Commissioner Johnson's leadership in convening the Alaska's Education Challenge. According to longtime education policy observers, Alaska Education Challenge represented the largest and most effective convening of stakeholders, parents, educators, administrators, and policymakers. In fact, members of this very committee served on the subcommittee that built that consensus and crafted the final public commitments and trajectories. For the first time in many years, we truly had all hands on deck focused on improving student outcomes. Senate Bill 8 itself arguably addresses all five of the priorities which emerged from Alaska's Education Challenge, three of them certainly directly. One, to close the achievement gap by ensuring equitable educational rigor and resources. Two, to improve the safety and well-being of students through school partnerships with families, communities, and tribes. And thirdly, and of course most directly, to support all students to read at grade level by the end of third grade. In fact, the Alaska Education Challenge document reads in part, and I quote, "Research suggests that school readiness at an early age is one critical strategy for improving student outcomes and closing racial and ethnic and socioeconomic achievement gaps, unquote. If we're serious about improving reading proficiency by third grade, we absolutely must expand access to high-quality voluntary pre-kindergarten education by making it available to the students who need it most. The collaborative effort of Alaska's Education Challenge crystallized into legislation last year, of course. Over the course of countless stakeholder engagement efforts, and by my count, at least seven Senate Education Committee hearings, administrators, educators, and reading advocates from all across Alaska worked together to craft policy language that put students first. This was truly a collective and deliberative effort. And Mr. Chairman, I know my members would appreciate me being clear and putting this on the record that the policies detailed in Senate Bill 8 represent that collective effort. Educators felt like they were heard, respected, and consulted in the policymaking process. A quality reading program is a good start. Sound pedagogy and best practices in reading instruction is essential. And appropriate interventions and supports for students are also necessary, of course, all included in the bill. That said, Alaska educators know that any effort to improve reading and student outcomes in Alaska needs to begin with enhanced early learning opportunities. It is an unfortunate fact that Alaska is only one of only a handful of states that does not offer statewide voluntary pre-K education. In comparison, it cannot be overlooked that states which have been cited as reading successes, such as Florida and Mississippi, do in fact offer such a voluntary early childhood education programs. There's a critical and obvious connection between high-quality early learning opportunities and improved student outcomes. The research is definitive in its findings that these students not only become more proficient readers, but because reading is such a fundamental skill in terms of knowledge acquisition, that their success extends into other academic areas as well, that these students are more prepared for K-12 education, and that the gains persist far beyond the early years, and they are more likely to be successful as adults and live as more productive citizens. High quality, culturally responsive pre-K programs aligned with kindergarten standards help provide a strong foundation for pre-reading and school readiness skills, both academically and non-academic skills that lead to success in school. Examples of non-academic skills might be social and emotional competency and self-regulation skills. In addition, it allows for early identification of learning difficulties and subsequently earlier intervention for special needs children or those who have endured adverse childhood experiences, and extra support as well for English language learners and struggling learners. And all of this provides a better opportunity, this early work, for them to get on track by the third grade and be able to catch up with their peers. We all know that many students are already reading well by third grade, but those are typically from more affluent homes with a strong support network of parents and other adults who guide and assist in their learning. It's been shown that students who are read to regularly by their parents have a million word reading advantage by the time they enter kindergarten as compared to those who don't. Further, those who don't have that support are disproportionately from economically disadvantaged households and are disproportionately students of color. This is why a publicly funded statewide early education program is so important. According to a report by the All-Alaska Pediatric Partnership that was published just last year, depending on where young children live in the state, there may be few resources available in their communities to meet needs for health care, nutritious food, family supports, early interventions, and early childhood education. And they may be more likely to live in poverty. And I was actually shocked to learn that they observed that fully 36% of young children in Alaska, and that's a little bit more broadly defined than just those that would be in pre-K. They say ages birth to 8 years old, but 36% of the children in Alaska live in poverty. That's more than a third of our young children who likely would benefit most from early childhood education. By investing in this early childhood education statewide, we better assure that students most in need will get the support that they need to live up to the promise of public education in Alaska and the deed mission of providing an excellent education for every student every day. The Education Commission on the States cited a study from Nobel laureate James Heckman, who followed two generations of low-income families whose children participated in high-quality early learning programs. Students in the study were more likely to graduate from high school, they had higher IQs, they experienced better overall health, and they were less likely to be incarcerated than their peers who did not experience high-quality early learning programs. These results held constant across socioeconomic status and race. All of these factors led to society paying less for these students later in life. And Heckman calculated that the rate of return on the investment at 13% per year for every dollar invested in early learning. The Education Committee on the States also cited a 2016 report from Duke University that indicated that the impacts of early childhood education programs can be seen all the way through fifth grade. The study, which followed students in North Carolina, shows that students who participated in state-funded early education programs between 1995 and 2010 scored higher on math and literacy tests in third through fifth grade than their peers who did not participate in high-quality pre-K. Further, schools were less likely to retain those students in third through fifth grade, and these students were less likely to need special education services. A separate study in Alabama also demonstrated that the gains from early education program made in reading and math skills persisted even longer, at least to the seventh grade. Each of these studies' results are clear indications that the gains made in the pre-K space are fundamental to a student's academic success and to provide students with an equitable entry into education. Additional research demonstrates that there are significant and measurable effects of a voluntary, high-quality, publicly funded pre-kindergarten education program on both the economy and crime reduction. In his 2007 study, Enriching Children, Enriching the Nation, economist Robert G. Lynch found that investment in high-quality pre-kindergarten programs generates billions of dollars in economic benefits. His research also demonstrated, similar to the previous study cited, that children who participate in high-quality pre-kindergarten require fewer special education services, are less likely to repeat a grade, and less reliant on child welfare services. Mr. Chairman and committee members, the positive impact of high-quality early learning is an area of consensus among educators. We know that investments in high-quality pre-K programs will lead to improved outcomes, and we have an obligation to offer those opportunities to the students who need them most. Right here in Alaska, our school districts with pilot pre-K programs have shown improvements in outcomes and readiness. It's time. Frankly, it's long overdue to extend those opportunities to the students statewide who need the support most. Senate Bill 8 embodies the best ideas and the best efforts of years of careful collaboration as not only a single piece of legislation, but the culmination of the collective efforts of the entire education community and a serious and sincere policy collaboration between the governor, the Department of Education, legislators, and stakeholders. If we're serious about improving outcomes for Alaska students, we must start with voluntary, high-quality pre-kindergarten opportunities for our young people. In fact, I would go as far as to say is that moving forward with a bill without providing this kind of robust early education program could very likely appear short-sighted in only a few years from now. That would be a missed opportunity. Senate Bill 8 is that collaborative and comprehensive legislation which can truly have an impact on improving reading among Alaska students. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to testify today. I'd be happy to provide the committee with copies of the academic research I cited, and will do my best to answer questions from committee members should there be any.
Thank you, President Claymire. Are there any questions? Question from Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom, I'm just going to clarify a thing that you said earlier. When you mentioned the million-word gap, of course, there's only 171,000 words in the English language. What you meant was, because I just looked it up, is the Ohio State University study that says that there a kid who hasn't gone through pre-K hears a million and a half, approximately a million and a half fewer words, as a consequence, doesn't develop vocabulary. I just want to clarify that for the record. Is that correct?
Yes, thank you for citing the source. But yes, that's what I meant, that in terms of their learning, they've heard a million more words in a structured way when having been read to, as opposed to those who weren't. Not that they knew a million more words. That's not what I intended. And thank you for that clarification through the chair.
Senator Begich, thank you. I learned something. I didn't realize there were so few words. Senator Machicki.
Well, thank you. Just to correct Senator Begich, I'm from the South. We have far more words than that down there. You just don't recognize them as being words. But my actual question, could you threw out a lot of data, and I'm actually interested in digging very deep. I've been covering some of the reports and some of the studies that have been shared. But could you please, obviously not today, but perhaps forward a citation of that data to the chair, please, for us to take a review of those studies.
Through the chair, Senator McChicky, I'll be glad to, and I think I will be able to have staff provide that for you today. But if not, it'll be this week for sure.
Thank you.
Senator Stevens?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I appreciate your comments, and we're learning a lot here. But I'm going to ask several people as they testify, what is your personal experience with reading? Can you share that with us? Did you take early pre-K? Tom, I'm talking to you because I know you're very successful in your life, and I'd just like to know, what was your personal experience?
Yes, thank you, through the chair, Senator Stevens. I was an Air Force brat, so moved around quite a bit, and so I did, both of my parents worked, and so I did attend early learning programs, although not throughout my entire, what would be the pre-K years. It was a little bit spotty, but I did have, parents who read to me every day and, made sure to encourage. In fact, my dad, when he was stationed in Thailand at the end of the Vietnam War, I actually still have a cassette tape cover. I don't have the actual tape, but my dad would record himself reading books like Dr. Seuss and that sort of thing. He would record them from Thailand. And as kids, my sister and I were able to have those recordings. So even though our dad was deployed, we were still able to have him read to us, which I think contributed to my love of reading and certainly my love of my dad, right?
Thank you, Tom. I greatly appreciate those comments.
Thank you, President Claymire. One more question from Senator Hughes.
Well, it's maybe a question or a comment, and whether it's a sponsor, Mr. Claymire. A lot of the studies, I understand, are looking at children who go to preschool and then maybe, because the studies are older, have gone to preschool but haven't necessarily gone through a school program that's had a great literacy program. And I would agree with those studies that those kids that had the advantage of pre-K did better. I also understand there are some studies that show many catch up regardless. But what I'm wondering is, if you have a fantastic literacy program in a district and you compared a child who did not go to pre-K with a child who went to pre-K, after they went through that fantastic literacy program, how they would compare in the end. And that's where I think the research maybe is lacking. And if there is such research out there, I'd like to know it, because I think that's something we here must contend with, considering the fiscal situation that we're in. I think if a reading program is done well, I was in grade school a long time ago, but you learn to read. Every child learned to read, and they would not be promoted unless they learned to read. And we did not have pre-K. So, and I was not from an advantage area. It was low and middle class, and but the schools were very strict about teaching children to read. So I'm just wondering, are there studies out there that look at fantastic literacy programs like the Read by Nine that's been implemented and compare children who enter that having gone to pre-K or not having gone to pre-K, and how the outcomes are in the end?
Mr. Chairman?
I'm sorry, was that a question or just a statement?
Wondering if there's any research out there on that. And Senator Begich has
Oh, Senator Begich.
Yeah, there's a number of studies that talk about the integration of the two. The seminal one that we've talked about, Heckman's work in the Perry preschool study, precisely identifies that relationship between pre-kindergarten and strong literacy. The tendency, which we've cited before a couple times in committee, but which we can make sure we get I think we already have a copy of that in the file, but if we don't, we'll make sure it's posted. That study showed that while they had a strong reading program, without a pre-K program, they didn't get a lot of success. So when they combined the two with a universally strong pre-K program and with the reading program, it worked. Oklahoma is another example of that process. Here in our own state, where a number of our kids come to school as second language learners, not just in my urban district, but in rural Alaska,
the pre-K advantage has allowed kids to be able to read when they came into kindergarten. That's actually in our own data here in the state of Alaska. So we can show that when a kid comes with the pre-kindergarten preparation here in the state, and I think perhaps Superintendent Burgess or perhaps Superintendent Bishop will be talking about that later. But when you actually provide that, if you will, boost or that second start, they have better ability to comprehend. And then with a strong, and this is where the strong literacy program is critical, without that strong literacy program, a number of these studies have also shown, including the ones that people cite when they go after Head Start, for example, they all seem to point to the same thing. The gains are lost if you don't have a strong literacy program as well, which is why the two work so well in tandem, Senator Hughes, is because you prep the kids so that they're able to learn, and especially in a state like ours where, in my district, you know, we have the largest minority population of an urban area in Alaska. It's one of the most diversified Senate districts in the nation. But in our rural districts, the number of second language learners or those who come to school with a different language as part of their learning apparatus, if you will, need that pre-kindergarten preparation to succeed. So that the data is there. We provided it in the past, but we can clarify it in a short memo, which we'll provide to you no later than tomorrow, to identify each of those studies so that you can know if they are in the packet already, where they are, and if they're not, we'll provide them.
Okay, thank you.
I'm also going to comment on that because I don't know if I'm talking about the same Tennessee study or a different Tennessee study, but and I apologize, I don't have it in front of me, but my recollections of it was an $85 million a year plan covering 18,000 students, and that all the pre-K advances were lost by the end of the first kindergarten year.
Yeah.
And that there was, I don't recall the successes that you recall from it, and I'll provide that one to you as well. Senator Hughes?
Yeah, and then I just wonder sometimes, are we sure that what's correlating is the pre-K and the early literacy for the success? Because I know in other countries that have delayed start where the children are a little bit older before they begin to learn to read, and they learn very readily as a group without the frustrations that some teachers are dealing with younger students. And that delayed start, we all are aware it's in Finland, but also it's in Denmark, Singapore, Sweden, South Africa, and four different parts of Australia also do delayed start. So I'm thinking by having children a little bit older, that could, also give as much advantage to as pre-K might, and there would be no cost factor for it.
Mr. Chairman, may I respond to that?
Senator Begich?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and as I mentioned in testimony, I think 2 weeks ago now, not every one of those, but Sweden, Finland, Denmark, all of them have rates of 90% or better for early learning in their states. Every one of them may have late starts, but that's because they also do birth to that date of early learning in preparation. The Tennessee study is in the packet. The study you're citing is exactly the study that led them to look at why wasn't the pre-K work holding, what was going on here. And so they ended up combining it with early literacy. That's precisely why the bill was written the way it was and why the commissioner and the governor approached me, was precisely because of that linkage between the two. If you do early education, even high quality early education, but you don't have literacy, you don't retain the gains. If you do high quality literacy education, but you haven't prepared kids to be able to access that learning, you don't get the gains. These are why we combine the two in the bill. It's precisely why we spent literally hundreds of hours trying to develop what will work for Alaska, because Alaska has these very unique situations. We have first language and second language learners. We have kids in rural environments and kids in urban environments and semi-urban environments. We have to find the mix that works for them, and that's where the work led us to. President Claymore cited the Alaska Challenge. We didn't do the Alaska Challenge because we thought it would feel good. We did the Alaska Challenge because we thought it would do good. And that's what we think that this bill, which builds on all of that work, does. So that's if you want additional information on what scientists, and that's who I rely on, have said about the impacts of early education do. We have the items we presented last week, but I have additional research, which I'm happy to provide. The more I provide, the more I hope you have time to look at them all, but the most recent one I have is a 2017 study on the impacts of early education, childhood education, medium and long-term educational outcomes, because we want to know whether these things are retained over time. And that's why this entire bill has been built on the research that's out there, and it includes not just the Heckman study, which is an ongoing study, multi-generational, but also the most recent research. It's not based on the 1960s analysis. It's based on analyses up to date.
Thank you, Senator Begich. With no other questions, thank you, President Claymire, for your presentation. We do have Carrie Boyd available at this time. Carrie Boyd, Superintendent of the Yukon Koyukuk School District. Ms. Boyd, I believe you're on the phone. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
If you'd like to put yourself on the record and do your presentation.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Carrie Boyd, President of the Alaska Superintendents Association, known as ASA, and also Superintendent of Yukon Koyukuk School District for the last 14 years. Thank you so much for inviting me to testify. Sorry, I was in a staff meeting earlier, testify on Senate Bill 8, the Alaska READS Act. ASA has been closely reviewing and studying Senate Bill 8 since last year when it was Senate Bill 6. Our members have provided extensive feedback to the bill sponsor and the Commissioner of Education, including countless discussions that resulted in improvements to the bill that are widely accepted and endorsed today by the education community. Through a formal process within ASA, the members voted to support SB 8. They felt very strongly about it and still do. The extensive, transparent, and inclusive vetting process resulted in a very good nonpartisan bill with broad support. The Alaska READS Act provides districts with a solid reading plan, continuity for areas of our state where there's such a high turnover, and clear expectations of what is expected with reading programs no matter where a student attends school. It is of critical importance to expand access to high-quality pre-K programs to all children, and that combining this with an evidence-based reading program and intensive reading interventions for students struggling with reading provides the best opportunity to ensure improved reading outcomes for Alaska students. The support and resources from DEED, professional development, teacher and paraprofessional training, intensive reading program specialists, and support are exactly the kind of capacity building necessary for the Department of Ed and early development to be best able to support our schools and students to ensure a successful and effective implementation of the reading program. Having a statewide plan for reading is what our state needs, it's what our students and our staff need. In our joint position statements that ACSA leadership reviewed with you in our last meeting, we shared that according to the 2019 Alaska Developmental Profile, nearly 70% of Alaska students enter kindergarten lacking foundational preparation for learning. We support the definition of elementary education to include pre-K, thus ensuring equitable access to fully funded, sustainable birth to age 5 learning programs. This provides a foundation of critical social, emotional, and cognitive instruction to students. Research clearly demonstrates early intervention instruction is one of the best ways to decrease opportunity gaps across all demographics and create the greatest opportunity for all students to read proficiently by third grade and to minimize our dropout rate. I heard some of the discussion talking about literacy programs, which are very essential for our students. When our students come into schools below proficient where we are expecting them to be, it makes it very difficult for teachers. They're going to have to gravitate towards the mean and spend more time getting the other students caught up to where they need to be, as opposed to starting those other critical skills that are expected by kindergarten. Along with Governor Dunleavy, the DEED Commissioner Johnson, and bill sponsor, we, ASA, support adequate early child education and pre-K funding as a part of this base student allocation as outlined in the bill before you. Families, young children, and early childhood educators in Alaska have experienced the negative impacts that have been associated with not having a pre-K funded program for many years. In sum, we support strongly SB 8 and encourage you to move up forward with it with all the component pieces. Thank you for your time and consideration. And by the way, I went to a German preschool. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent Boyd, for your comments. Any questions or comments from the committee?
Just very quick.
Senator Bagich.
I did. It is in the packet that Tennessee isn't giving up on pre-K article is in the packet that we submitted, just for your information. And I wanted to thank Superintendent Boyd for telling us about her German preschool experience.
I find it interesting to hear everyone's pre-K experiences.
Thank you, Senator Bagich. With no other questions, we will move on to Dr. Kimyanu Burke, Policy Director, Foundation for Excellence in Education. Dr. Burke, did I get your name correctly there? Oh, I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Are you muted?
No, I'm not muted.
Oh. We're having a little bit of a volume problem here. We'll see if we can work on that. Go ahead and give us a quick few words.
Okay.
We have you now.
All right. Good morning, everyone. I'm Kimyanu Burke. I am the Policy Director for Early Literacy for the Foundation for Excellence in Education. I'm also the former State Literacy Director for the Mississippi Department of Education. So I led our implementation of the Literacy-Based Promotion Act from its inception in 2013 until 2019, where I left to go and support the restructuring of one of our largest school districts here in Mississippi. And then I made it to Excel in Ed. So my role at Excel in Ed is to support states that are either passing, developing or passing early literacy policies, but then also to support state chiefs and state education agency literacy leaders during the implementation of the process. So thank you so much for having me today.
All right.
And I will go ahead with the slides. I think someone is there who is going to advance those slides for me. Okay, great, thank you. Okay, so I will start with the components of the Literacy-Based Promotion Act. Now, I heard a testimony earlier speaking to the importance of pre-K, and I think that sometimes what is not mentioned in Mississippi's early literacy efforts is that we did pass, during the same time as the Literacy-Based Promotion Act, we passed an Early Learning Collaborative Act, which focused on pre-K. It was not funded nearly as much as our Literacy-Based Promotion Act was, but the focus was to create pilots and early learning collaboratives that included either a Head Start agency, an early childhood, maybe a private or public early childhood program, and then also for them to collaborate with a school district and become a partnership with a school district to ensure that those four-year-olds were ready for kindergarten when they entered kindergarten. So that's just an aside that we did pass a law at the same time as the LBPA. So I'll talk a little bit about the components that were included or that are included in our Literacy-Based Promotion Act. And I'll just kind of go clockwise. So educator training, this was extremely important because we had to develop here a common language for reading instruction. What is the science of reading? And we knew just from experience, but then also from being last in the nation, that our teacher prep programs weren't necessarily preparing our teachers to be able to teach all students, even students who have reading challenges with learning how to read on day one. So we considered it a blank slate. And we set up for all of our educators who are teaching kindergarten through third grade, our special education teachers teaching kindergarten through eighth grade, and then all of our administrators who were principals at elementary schools, we provided professional development in the science of reading for all of those groups. So we began with those groups, and then we decided, okay, well, if our teachers are going through teacher prep programs and they're coming out not prepared, then we'll invite the reading professors from our institutions of higher learning to attend training as well. Now, initially, that didn't go over well. You know, you had some professors that said, sure, I'll come. And once they realized how much work it involved with going through that type of rigorous training, many of them said, well, they really didn't have the time. So there was a bill passed later, maybe 3 years later, that included a licensure exam for those who were getting a license in elementary education. Now they had to pass an additional exam in the science of reading to ensure that they were prepared before they were even licensed. And that's what got our buy-in with our institutions of higher learning to where they actually, at this point, began to see themselves in the outcomes of our kindergarten through third grade students. So for educator training, we were like, come one, come all. We're offering this training and the state agency is paying for it out of legislative appropriations. So we begin with that, developing a common knowledge for teaching reading. The next really, really important piece was our on-site coaching for teachers. Now that you've learned what you've learned in professional development about how to teach reading, we're going to put someone in your building who can assist you with the transfer of that knowledge to the classroom. And that's what our literacy coaches did. They were on site in our lowest performing schools in the state, and they worked there through the entire school year to work with teachers. And what we also found was they coached administrators as well. They had to ensure that, I'm not sure how it is in Alaska, but here, of course, if you're a high school teacher and you've gotten your license in administration and an opening comes up at the elementary school, then lo and behold, you are now an elementary school administrator. And many of those administrators had not had any elementary experience, and they needed to know how to provide feedback to the teachers in their building about whether instruction was being effective, especially in those K-2 areas. So we coached teachers, and then in some cases, we coached administrators as well. The next component, early identification, testing with intention, universal screeners, being sure that you collect baseline data for your students within the first 30 days for first through third grade, and then, of course, the first 45 days for your kindergarten students to know where they are and to guide teachers in the types and also the intensity of the interventions that they're going to provide to students. So early identification is key. Parent communication, we had to ensure that our parents knew that they were partners to the work. My first 2 years, I say all the time that it was completely PR. It was going across the state, having parent meetings. We had 8 parent meetings the first year. Our law was passed in 2013, and I think it's no secret that we had to promote the retention piece. But our retention piece was not going to go live until 2015. So we had 2 years to prove and to convince all of our stakeholders that what we were doing was best for children, with putting that that piece in the law. But then also with educating parents about what are good cause exemptions, you know, what types of reports should you be receiving when your child takes this universal screener. My daughter was in the first cohort to take that assessment in 2015. She was in their first third grade cohort. So I spoke to parents as a parent. These are some things you need to know. If you don't see that screening report at the end of the 30 days, you need to ask for it. So we had to be sure that we were empowering parents to be a part of the conversation, and then also making sure that they were being notified early and often of their child's progress and what the school would do to ensure that their child, their reading deficiencies were being addressed. Next, individual reading plans. We went back and had this amendment added to our law in 2016, so about 3 years afterwards. So, you know, it wasn't all that we did everything right from the beginning. It's never that. What we realized was that we had put into the law that students had to receive these interventions, these intensive interventions. But what we didn't realize was that that language of intensive interventions looked completely different all across the state, whether there were schools in the same district that were looking at it differently. So we fashioned our law after Florida's, and Florida had individual reading plans. We just didn't have it in ours initially. So we added individual reading plans to ensure accountability at a few levels, actually, to ensure that our teachers were providing those interventions to students. And in these reading plans, they were documenting what they were doing. And then with the progress monitoring, they were checking to see if what they were providing was actually working. So that was the goal and the purpose of the individual reading plans to address that. And then I'll talk a little bit on the next slide about how we were able to invest in those types of supports for teachers. But our last component, prevention over retention. So we did have the, we do have the retention piece here in Mississippi, but our focus was more on prevention and intervention than retention. Simply because once you identify students early at the beginning of the year, you already know which students are at risk of failure, of failing that particular grade. So the question is, what are you doing from August when school begins to April when our state testing begins to ensure that students are ready? You know, it's not about what's going to happen in May or what's going to happen in April. It's what's going to happen in these months leading to the final and comprehensive assessment of students. So that's what we focused on in the Literacy-Based Promotion Act. Next slide. Okay, so in our next slide, I'll talk a little bit about funding priorities. We didn't get a lot of money. There are states that received $40 million and all of these things. Tennessee's law that they just passed, they've invested $100 million into a Reading 360 program over the next couple of years, in addition to legislation that they also passed to strengthen their literacy policies. But in Mississippi, our very first year in 2013, the legislature appropriated $9.5 million. And since then, beginning in 2014, we have received an annual $15 million appropriation. So I'm going to talk about how that those funds were really kind of broken down across as it relates to our priorities. As you can see, the largest priority and the largest gain was really our literacy coaching support. It included our coaches' salaries, their travel, the professional development that they were doing, whether it was on site or whether it was they also did professional development for groups of districts at a time where they went across the state to do professional development. So we included that literacy coaching support on site, rental of space and those things to host district-wide professional development or regional-wide professional development. So a majority of our money went to that. And I always say we invested more in people than programs. Invest in your people, because those are the ones who are going to be standing in front of students. Our curriculum may change, but once you empower our teachers with the knowledge and the know-how and the support, that is where you get the most bang for your buck. And that's how we invested in Mississippi. 17% went to professional development. This was our science of reading professional development that we had specifically for those groups that I named initially, K-3 teachers, our administrators, K-8 special education teachers. We have trained since spring of 2014 approximately 14,000 educators, and now that includes about 38 reading professors. So now we have extended this professional development in the science of reading to our kindergarten through 12th grade teachers, because we all know that there are students who are sitting in middle school classrooms and in high school classrooms who are struggling readers, and their teachers do not know what to do to address those deficiencies. The next piece, 15% went into our assessment system, where we actually reimburse our school districts for the purchase of their universal screener, again, which provides that baseline data, but then also for any retests that must occur at the end of third grade, our funds pay for those retests. And we also put 3% in K-3 literacy support. And that's what I mentioned earlier about identifying as we began implementing that we had some gaps at the State Department, that we could not really support schools because we didn't have certain personnel. We did not have an Office of Early Childhood. When we passed the Literacy-Based Promotion Act and the Early Learning Collaborative Act, we did not. So we stood up an Office of Early Childhood. My position as State Literacy Director K-3 became Literacy Director K-12. We also created an Office of Intervention Services to be able to provide that type of support to teachers and training around what Tier 2 interventions were, what Tier 3 interventions were, and how they could progress monitor that. And then we also hired an English language learner specialist to ensure that we were providing that support for our schools as our EL population had begun to grow. And finally, we were able to, now these offices were not large offices by any means. When I say we provided or funded, it may have been that director or that director and one other person. And lastly, we spent some of the funds to pay for salaries for professional development coordinators. And then lastly, we put money into summer reading camp support grants over a 3-year period where school districts could submit an application to receive $50,000 per summer for over 3 years to host summer reading camp and provide those opportunities to whether it was students who had been flagged for having reading deficiencies, kindergarten, first or third grade, second or third grade, and also those students who may have failed third grade. All right, next slide. Now let's look at some data. All right. Why a comprehensive state-led approach? Earlier literacy efforts yielded successful pilots. And I think the young man who was on first talked about, you know, piloting in certain districts and seeing that success, but it did not lead to sustainable statewide improvement for the entire state, not just for those students who were fortunate enough to be involved in a pilot. So the Barksdale Reading Institute is an amazing partner to the Mississippi Department of Education. In the year 2000, Jim Barksdale invested $100 million into Mississippi over 10 years to support early literacy efforts. If you remember, that's the same year that the National Reading Panel Report came out. So the efforts that they began to implement mirrored what the National Reading Panel Report said that we needed. The components of reading, science of reading, literacy instruction, evidence-based, those things. But the efforts that the Barksdale Reading Institute put into place were in pilots. They were in certain districts, some of our lowest performing school districts that really needed the support. The teachers were trained in the science of reading. So that may have been a pilot where they were going to train teachers. And then another pilot could have been that they were going to now focus on administrators and leaders and them being literacy leaders in their building. And then another pilot would focus on something else. So as you can see, if you look at this NAEP data, the blue line, of course, is Mississippi's data. And the broken lines are the national data as it relates to NAEP back from 1998. As you can see, Barksdale was founded in 2000, and you will look at our NAEP scale scores and how they would go up and then go down and go up and go down, and it was just very inconsistent. But those districts who were participating in pilots, they would have success for a period of time. But once the money was gone and once the support was gone, then those districts really kind of fall back into the same practices that they had prior. So it really wasn't until 2013, when we passed the Literacy-Based Promotion Act, that we began to see gains, and those gains have steadily increased over the years. One thing that people forget about, I think we talked a lot about 2019, when our scores were, when Mississippi was the only state in the nation to have the reading gains that we had. But we also had statistically significant gains in 2015, which was 2 years after our Literacy-Based Promotion Act passed and the year that retention went into place for third grade. But this was the fourth grade group who scored the 214. If you ask our former governor, who's amazing, Governor Phil Bryan, what did that for us? He'll say, specifically, Literacy-Based Promotion Act. We started training those teachers when those students were in second grade. We put our coaches in the schools. We did all of these things in the schools. So by the time these fourth graders took this assessment, then they had already had a couple of years of teachers who were into the science of reading, and they were able to give us these gains. If you ask Dr. Wright, our amazing state superintendent, current state superintendent, she will say that it was a combination of the Literacy-Based Promotion Act. During that time, we also adopted our college and career readiness standards. We can't say Common Core here anymore. So our college and career readiness standards, at the same time adopting an assessment that was aligned to those standards and were as rigorous as NAEP. So that's when we began to see the successes, and we've been able to see an increase in our scale scores every year. And again, we started with, in 2013, literacy coaches in 50 schools, because those were the number of coaches that, you know, we had coaches. Each coach had two schools. But now we're up to about 75 coaches who are in 180 schools who provide support and on a gradual release model. So there are schools that are receiving full support from coaches. There are schools who that because they've seen such sustainable success, they're now receiving monthly support or even just quarterly support as we begin to pull schools and take schools off of our list of literacy coaching support. Okay, next slide. And on this slide, it just shows our 10-year gains on NAEP in fourth grade and eighth grade. So I guess an unintended consequence is that as we begin to see our scores in reading increase, our percentage of students scoring proficient and above increase in fourth grade reading, we also begin to see those the same thing happen in math. So if you look at fourth grade reading and fourth grade math, as you can see, there was a 10% increase of our students in the proficient and advanced category. And in math, there was a 17% increase. And also to, for eighth grade, we have seen gains in percentage of our students scoring in those categories as well in eighth grade reading and also in eighth grade math. So this is my presentation. I think the last slide is just my contact information. And I am open to answer any questions if you have them. And thank you for the opportunity to share.
Thank you, Dr. Bird, for your presentation. I see a question from Senator Begich.
So if we could go back to slide two, Ed, real quick. Dr. Burke, a couple of things that I wanted to just reinforce from your presentation. The educator training component, coaching for teachers, early identification, parent communication, individual reading plans, and prevention as a focus are all parts of this bill. You had mentioned our hope was to do everything right at the beginning, at the forefront, but you had to make adjustments. And so we have learned from your adjustments in crafting this legislation by incorporating many of the things you've just described. In particular, I want to focus in on the individual reading plans and the idea that we do early assessments, three-time assessments, multiple contacts to parents, ensuring that those assessments are built around what we find out about the youth. And I wanted to also thank you and reemphasize that you mentioned the Early Learning Collaborative Act, which is something I had some notes on here. But the 219 report to the Mississippi Legislature from the Legislative Committee on Performance Evaluation and Expenditure showed a general trend, and I'm reading from my notes, the general trend that children who attended the pre-K did better on the assessments and tests than the control groups. A report specifically said, and I'm quoting from the report now, a closer look at these sites, those sites with statistically significant improvements could provide valuable insights into what factors might be contributing to these positive results. End quote, reinforcing something Senator Hughes said earlier is that you're studying the impact and the close relationship between early learning and the success, and your reports, at least by 2019, are beginning to show some correlation there. So would you just offer a brief comment on that for the group?
Yeah.
I didn't prep
this, sure.
So, but go ahead.
Yeah. Sure. With our Early Learning Collaborative Act, our legislature began, they appropriated, I believe, $3 million initially. It went to $4 million. Now it's at $6 million per year with a match from the Kellogg Foundation of $6 million per year. So what we've done in those early learning collaboratives is that model is now mirroring our K-3 model. So they have literacy coaches in that model. They do professional development. Those pre-K students take a kindergarten readiness assessment. So if you look at our data, it does show that we've done the comparison. Our state superintendent, some years ago, once we began collecting this data after the law passed, we added this one component to our student information system to ask parents, where did your students go before they came to kindergarten? And that had just never been asked before. That was data that was collected at the school level. So we are able to compare our pre-K students to our Head Start students, to our students who are in early child care facilities, to our students who are coming from home. And from all of our data, it shows that our students who are in those early learning collaboratives are outperforming our students from any other of those entry points, ways to get into kindergarten. And it's because of all of the supports. And again, it's providing them with that experience. Our state superintendent is a fearless proponent of early childhood education. It's because of the exposure of the experience in early childhood that our students are more prepared when they get to kindergarten. And it's really all of it. it's then the teachers are now more prepared to receive them because of their training. And they're able to know where they are. Students are familiar with the structure of school, those kinds of things. But yes, we have the data to show, our state data that shows that our students in those early learning collaboratives that we've invested in are outperforming our students from any other entryway into kindergarten.
And Mr. Chairman, the reason, if I may, Mr. Chairman, the reason I asked that question is I think it's important. That's new data. That's the newest data, and it shows that relationship. And I think, you know, in this bill, SB 8, all of those elements are included. And so that, to me, is something that's worth taking note of, in particular those comments just made by Dr. Burke. So appreciate that.
Senator Hughes?
So thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have two questions. One's a quick follow-up. Dr. Burke, thank you very much. And by the way, I enjoyed a panel hearing from Mississippi teachers at an Excel in Ed conference a couple of years ago. They were pretty excited about the turnaround in Mississippi. So you mentioned 2013, the legislature passed the Literacy Act paired with the Collaborative Act regarding pre-K. And I'm wondering at that time what the percentage or rough percentage of kids were in public pre-K in 2013 and compared to now, because you still had great success, but you mentioned that you did not, Mississippi did not have funding associated with that Collaborative Act.
Well, there was funding associated with the Collaborative Act, and I don't have the percentage. We have a very low percentage. I think the young man stated earlier that we have universal pre-K. We do not have universal pre-K in Mississippi. We have 18 early learning collaboratives that are state funded for that particular effort. Any other pre-K that we have in Mississippi is funded through Title I, and it's those are the districts that decide that they have the money that they want to offer pre-K in their district. So it's the only state investment in pre-K is through those early learning collaboratives. In 2013-14, the legislature put in $3 million. It just wasn't a lot of money, but we had money. And we started, I believe, with 11 collaboratives at that point. And as they've increased the funding, we're now up to 18 collaboratives. And I have the information that I can send through the Alaska Policy Forum, and I'm sure they'll send to, and I know they'll send to you, speaks to how many students or how many seats this funding through our Early Learning Collaborative Act, how many additional seats this funding is allowing for four-year-olds to be in early learning experiences. But I'll send that data to you.
And as follow-up to that, just to give us a picture, because I don't know what the population of Mississippi is, so $15 million a year for literacy, $3 million for collaboratives. What is the student population K-12? Do you know offhand? I think we're around 130,000 in this state, so I'm just wondering how Mississippi compares.
I can send that to you as well. I'll look at the superintendent's annual report that was just released. It has all of that in there. I'm just making a note of what I need to send to you.
And then my second question quickly, because I know we're short on time, is you mentioned that you had trouble initially with your higher education institutions training teachers, and I had the good pleasure of being online with a couple dozen superintendents for about an hour, a little over a week ago, and they were pretty honest with me and forthright. And they mentioned that the newly graduated teachers from our university system, one campus is doing well, the other two campuses, they're not being prepared well for reading instruction. You mentioned a licensure requirement. Is there a testing requirement associated with that, or a grade point average for the reading instruction course, or how do they meet the licensure requirement?
There is a license and there is an exam. There's a assessment of the science of reading. It's called the Foundations of Reading Exam. I believe that Massachusetts may have been the first state to implement that. So in addition to the Praxis 1 and the Praxis Core that pre-service teachers have to take, there's now a third assessment for those who want to be licensed in elementary education, and that is the Foundations of Reading Assessment. They must pass with a cut score now of 229. We've talked a lot lately about revisiting that cut score and raising it, but they have to pass with a cut score of 229 in order to be licensed to teach reading, to teach in elementary schools. And so initially, we did have parents and families. I had parents and families to call me at the State Department of Ed to say, my child who was in pre-service cannot pass this assessment. And we've spent this money on a four-year education, and now they can't even pass this assessment to get the license, right? So, of course, that catches the attention of now more than just K-3 parents. It now catches the attention of parents who are investing in a college of, in a college education and realizing that their child is now not prepared to be a teacher. So we not only offered that to our professors, we began to offer it to the pre-service candidates as well and said, if you want to on your own come to this training, then you can do that. We have so many emails of students who said, once I came to the training, I was able to pass the assessment. So that further, you know, lended itself to the conversations around what are we doing in these courses in teacher prep? There's no reason why we should, as a state, have to pay for training after pre-service teachers leave college when they should have gotten it during their regular teacher preparation program. So we do have a higher ed literacy council now where our professors come together. There's also a Barksdale Reading Institute is leading an initiative with our colleges of education where they now have a model that mirrors our K-3 model. Kellogg has invested in that as well, where our reading professors have a coach who's another university professor, and he would come into their classrooms, coach with them, assist them in whatever they needed as far as teaching their students the science of reading, how to administer assessments and those things. So, and we've done that piece, that collaborative piece, without legislation. It was really, now there's an accountability piece at the higher ed level. And that was the buy-in that, that we needed to have from them.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Senator Machicki.
Yeah, I don't, thank you. Dr. Burke, I don't know how fond you are of living in the South, but how excited you are about early learning. We may have to relocate you at some point.
No, you can't offer me a job while I'm on the call on behalf of my job.
Actually, my question is about parental progress. I recognize that gap just with my own kids and working in my schools at home. How was the progress with parents who are the kind of number one key to moving forward with especially the kind of pre-K age on the reading and the time they'll spend with their kids in development? Did the program, so you talked about parental communication, but how about parental development on the most efficient use of state dollars, which would be parents working with their kids? Was there a part of that of the program that involved that?
Yeah, so Kellogg, in the Early Learning Collaborative funding, we funded parent academies, where there's an entire series in a professional development for parents. And we created this model where school district would send kind of like their parent liaison or curriculum coordinator to trainings at the State Department of Ed. And they received a packet full of everything that was already printed, all of these resources, manipulatives and things. And they would then host trainings in their district for their parents to talk to them about ways in which they can support literacy at home, activities that they can do for their children, with their children at home. That was the pre-K piece. In our Literacy-Based Promotion Act, we had a very strong parental component, so not just the parent notification, but also the parent read-at-home plans. Well, we developed a parent read-at-home plan that specifically said, if you received the Universal Screener Report, and it says that your child has a deficit or a challenge in the area of phonics, then you can turn to this page, and this gives you all of these activities that you can do with your child at home with phonics, that you can have colored Fruit Loops, and you can have the child to, you know, say cat, and you can move those Fruit Loops or, you know, whatever you need to do in order to teach them that, you know, there are phonemes that go to these words, there are specific sounds, and then you match those to letters. All of those things are included in the parent read-at-home plan. And we also have a site dedicated to parents and also any other stakeholders or community people who would like to support reading in their communities. And it's called Strong Readers, Strong Leaders. So we came out with a full campaign. One of our former Miss Mississippi's was, kind of like our ambassador to it. And we ensured that we were informing parents, but also giving them resources. And in the individual reading plan, that actually has to be developed and have a parent's signature so that they'll know going forward throughout this year, these are some things that I can do at home, and these are the things that are going to occur at the school, and that I will be notified when progress monitoring is done, and that I will keep in contact with the teacher. So that was our biggest thing. I had parent meetings sometimes where there were in small districts where there were 100 people. One of our districts in the Delta actually got a school bus and went to communities and picked up parents to come to a 6 o'clock meeting. Because when you talk about retention and students being held back, parents want to know, okay, what is it that I need to do? But at the end of the day, I always say there's enough accountability for everyone. So parents, yes, you play a role, but also teachers, you play a role. You have to ensure that you're doing what you're supposed to do on your side to ensure that students don't get to the end of the year and there hasn't been any support provided. So a lot of it was really allowing parents to see. I showed them items on the assessment, sample items that their child would be taking, those kind of things. You have to be transparent. You can't wait until the end of the year and say, oh yeah, this is what the test looks like. So we had to do a lot of those things to get parents on board.
Thank you, Dr. Burke. Senator sure. Stevens.
Thank you. As a professional, successful with a PhD, what was your early experience or learning experience? Did you have pre-K?
Well, I there was a lady who babysat me, and my mom was an educator early on. My father was an educator as well. And then once my mom stopped working, she stayed home and raised kids. So I watched a lot of Reading Rainbow and Sesame Street. I did not have a formal pre-kindergarten experience, but I had a very, very strong kindergarten experience. Class sizes weren't as large as they are now. And I had just a very, very strong kindergarten and early education experience.
Thank you. Lucky you. Well done.
Yes.
All right, Dr. Burke, thank you for your presentation, answering the questions. I tell you, we're running short on time. We're not going to even make it to the end of our invited list of speakers today, but public testimony is important. We're going to review the schedule and probably start off the next meeting with finishing off the list of invited speakers and moving into public testimony. Next on the list today is Dr. Dina Bishop, Superintendent of the Anchorage School District. Dr. Bishop, if you'd like to put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Holland and members of the Senate Education Committee. For the record, I'm Dina Bishop, the Superintendent of the Anchorage School District. Thank you for accepting my testimony on Senate Bill 8 for reading pre-K elementary programs, as well as the funding. As Superintendent of the Anchorage School District, I want to communicate that the content of this bill, rather, preschool access, evidence-based reading instruction, and a focus on DEED's ability to positively impact and support districts with reading outcomes, I believe will be the most important bill heard this legislative session. The future of our state has a stronger relationship to what its children can know and be able to do now, as well as 20 years from now, than any singular financial or social impact legislation. My 31-year educational experience, including my time as superintendent in the two largest school districts in our state, has brought the issue of student reading outcomes front and center as a crisis. Alaska cannot and will not improve student learning outcomes at any level without a strong reading base. We all know where Alaska's students' elementary learning outcomes stand in comparison to other states in our nation. They're last. The reading research is clear on how to make meaningful changes via strong research-based curriculum and pedagogy. Added to this body of work is evidence from other think tanks in the business realm. As we all know, the premise of a successful business is to realize a return on the investment. More specifically, real dollars matter. Early literacy via pre-K and strong reading instruction do provide the best value for the legislature's financial investment to schools. In short, Research from the Business Roundtable in 2016 makes it clear that by embracing the science of reading, a state will get a return on its investment, utilizing policy to ensure reading proficiency by third grade. Let's not just say in the 32nd legislature that we want to change and just say get better without the support needed from you. The change we all desire cannot be done without our collective investment in these six policy steps outlined in the research. Two of these steps already exist in our statutory language. Expanding access to high-quality pre-K learning is the first investment. Early learning is key. We've heard from that. Some kids win the parent lottery when they're born, and they're born into families that have all the resources needed for that early learning. Number two, we score high here. We offer high-quality kindergarten in our state, or rather full-day kindergarten. Our state is a star in this area. We pay for full-day kindergarten. Added to this is what's needed is a strong reading base occurring, the instruction at that level. The third point in policy is to use data and assessment to track our progress. Alaska has the data, but we now must use the data to inform our decisions around reading instruction. This was also mentioned by the prior speaker. Equip and train educators in grades pre-K through 3 to be great reading instructors. The reading wars are over in regard to whole language or letter, sound, spelling, knowledge. Science-based reading instruction in the 5 areas is critical. Teachers must explicitly teach phonemic awareness and phonics. The 5th item in policy should be to require systematic interventions for struggling readers. You heard this about the reading plans for each child or a different tier of instruction. MTSS, RTI, all of these are enclosed in that. Some students will need more intensive instruction to keep pace with grade level expectations. And then finally, most importantly, coordinate the governance of pre-K and grades K through 3 to promote efficiencies and maximize impact. Strong state level leadership and administration oversight are needed. The Senate Education holds a bill, Senate Bill 8, which makes actionable the additional steps needed to produce significant change in reading outcomes in our state. I am happy to speak more on this topic, specifically about my experience in schools. The legislation, however, is essential for the improvement that you and I both want to see in our children's learning and achievement in our great state of Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry, I lost my place. Thank you for your presentation. Dr. Bishop, any questions from the committee? Senator Stevens.
I'm just carrying on with my personal poll, Dr. Bishop. What was your personal experience? Did you take early learning pre-K when you were a child? How did you become such a good reader? Obviously, you are a good reader, having gotten a PhD.
Yeah. Well, it didn't start off that way. Both my parents worked, and I was in a daycare preschool probably from the time I was 2. So I guess I had some preschool, but honestly, the strength of my literacy grew after I learned whole language actually initially and suffered in poor spelling. So phonics and phonemic awareness matters even for advanced learning. It's when we get to those multisyllabic words that phonics and phonemic awareness and blending of sounds matters.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Senator Chickie?
Mr. Chairman, I have lots of questions on this subject, so I don't know what your plan is today, but we're running short on time, so I don't want to hold things up. I can always put my questions into an email and give it to you, and you can ask Dr. Bishop and others to answer them for the committee.
That'll be fine. We're about to wrap it up. I've reviewed Dr. Burgess's presentation. Superintendent Burgess's presentation. I don't believe we could fit it in the 2 minutes so we have left for the day today. But Dr. Bishop, thank you so much for your presentation. Apologies to Superintendent Burgess, Superintendent McManus, and Ms. Teschner. We didn't get to you today, and apologies to all the public testimony. You have over 20 people waiting online that we didn't get to them today as well. We will leave public testimony open till the next meeting. We'll now set SB 8 aside. Our next meeting is Wednesday, March 3rd. Is there any other business before the committee? Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I want to apologize to you personally for the confusion earlier in the meeting, and I thank you once again for your consideration. I just wanted to put that on the record.
Duly noted, Senator Begich. I apologize for any confusion I may have caused the committee. We're just moving through this process the way we think is appropriate, and hearing no other business before the committee, we are adjourned at 10:29.